You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 75. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
I'm talking about you. I'm talking about me. Long time back when the galaxy was new, man found out what he had to do. Found he had to eat and he found he had to drink. And a long time later he found he had
to... It's another episode, listeners.
That was terrible. welcome to episode 75 of the Tricorder Transmissions. Sorry for the crappy singing on the intro. I thought it would be a good idea. We are your hosts, Jeff Hewlett.
And Craig Cohen. And Jeff, I admire your courage there.
Thank you, sir. You inspired me. You inspired me. And believe me, I will not be going out for the voice after this as much as you might try to encourage me to do so. As mentioned last week, I've been waiting since the first episode of the Tricorder Transmissions to talk about The Way to Eden with you, Craig.
Yes, brother.
Yeah, this is one of those episodes that people trash, but you know, I have a soft spot for. So be prepared for me to do some defending of this episode, but I will not reveal now whether I will vote essential or non-essential. So you'll have to wait until the end of the episode for that reveal.
All right, right on.
Yeah. So before we get started with news, I want to just quickly take an aside just for a second. I know we usually don't break from Trek talk, but I saw something the other day. I watched a documentary that actually came out in November of 2014. So it's not super new, but it's still relatively new, and it really touched me. And I know it's not Trek related, but it is technology related. And any child of the 70s and early 80s, this will be particularly relevant to you. It was called Atari Game Over.
Oh, cool.
And it was about the legend of the E.T., the extraterrestrial cartridges that were buried in the desert.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Remember that legend?
Oh, yeah.
So this documentary covers the excavation of that burial site. And I won't reveal whether or not they actually find the cartridges. But interweaved throughout that expedition that they're on, there's all kinds of people who worked at Atari and made games for Atari that just talk about the genesis of the home video game market and the trend and essentially inventing a new form of media. And
ah, cool.
I think that anybody who listens to this show who's around our age would really enjoy that documentary. It's on Showtime right now. So look it up. It's also available on a bunch of on-demand services. So I'm not sure if it's on Netflix or not, but Atari Game Over, I can't recommend it enough. It's exceptionally cool.
Neat. Yeah, I don't think I ever beat E.T. I know we always got to the point where you put the thing together and called the ship, and we must have missed a step because we'd call the ship and it would never arrive and we'd get captured by the government agents.
Yeah, I don't recall if I ever beat it or not. I know my friend Steve, who actually owned the cartridge, did beat it, but I remember getting stuck in the pits a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had trouble getting out because I would get out and fall immediately back in.
Yeah, that was one of the dual joystick games, right? You used both joysticks?
I think you could.
Yeah, like Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark was like that too.
Yeah, that game I did beat.
Yeah.
That game I did beat. That was tough.
Yeah.
That game was tough.
Yeah, I like the idea of the two joysticks because it meant that if, you know, two of you were playing, you both had something to do.
Yeah, that's the very early days of co-op gaming. So
yes.
You know, now everything's co-op. And
yeah.
But God, the old days. But anyway, forgive me, listeners, for talking about that and taking up time with it. I hope nobody's too upset about that. So on to some Trek-related stuff. So William Shatner is saving California.
Yeah, his $30 billion Kickstarter he's going to do.
Yeah, he's going to pipe in water into California and save the state, which is suffering from horrible droughts. And I admire his tenacity with this. It's a huge undertaking. But I don't know how he's going to find time to write the Nimoy book when he's doing this.
Yeah, but I'll say this. If anybody can pull this off, it's William Shatner.
Yeah, God bless him. I mean, what a feather in a cap that would be. For William Shatner, if he could pull that off.
And you know there's probably going to be some very, very high ticket pledge levels.
Mm. Yeah, I would. Yeah, I'm sure there'll be people with $100,000 plus pledge levels. So maybe some of the richest folks will chip in. You know, your Warren Buffetts and your Bill Gates.
Goodness, you know. $30 billion.
That's a lot of money.
I can't wait to see what some of the rewards levels are. I really do.
Yeah, we'll definitely report back on that when that stuff is out there and available.
There's probably going to be a $1 billion reward.
You think?
I bet you there will be.
Someone's going to invest an entire billion, huh?
Or there's got to be a $1 million level.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, a lot of the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and startups, I'm sure, will want to contribute in some way.
Yeah, that'll probably be like dinner at Shatner's house or something. Limited to six or something. So boom, an easy 6 million.
You get to feed Shatner's horses. So there's a rumored title for the upcoming third Star Trek film.
Oh, right. I saw that they registered a domain, right?
Yeah. I don't know how I feel about it. So it's Star Trek Beyond. You know,
Sounds like a video game.
It really does. And I'm thinking, I kind of like the numbering scheme that they used to do with the old movies. So you kind of had a place and then like a subtitle underneath it is really cool. But, you know, I don't know how I feel about the naming that they've done, you know, with just the plain old Star Trek for the first one and then Into Darkness and now Beyond. I don't know. I guess maybe once we learn more about the storyline, we'll understand what Beyond is supposed to mean, if that's in fact the title. But at any rate, we can save that discussion for when more information is available.
Right.
Exciting announcement. Looks like our beloved Galaxy Quest is going to become a TV series.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, I'm down with that. That's pretty. I always love that movie. I know a lot of Trek fans love that movie.
Yeah.
So I'd be glad to see it come back. I thought they were working on a sequel, film sequel as well at some point.
Yeah, I guess not.
Perhaps not. All right. Well, that about wraps Z News section. Are you ready to get into The Way to Eden?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, The Way to Eden originally aired on February 21st of 69 and remastered June 14th, 2008.
All right, and we have the NBC press release that was issued on January 31st, 1969. Rebels capture the Enterprise and threaten its destruction unless they are taken to the planet Eden in The Way to Eden on NBC Television Network Star Trek, Friday, February 21st.
All right. Well, we will get started with our scene-specific commentary in 3, 2, 1.
So, wow, the ultra-rare non-Enterprise flyby opening.
Yeah, and this is the remastered one, so we're seeing a different little ship than we would have seen in the original version, but I think it's a cool little ship.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I like that. And how many space chase scenes do we see? You know, there's not a heck of a lot of them.
Yeah.
There's a few here and there, but that you know, this is one of those rare fun moments. It reminds me of the Harry Mudd spaceship chase from eons ago and back in season one.
Yeah, well, it's almost the same concept too, where they're pushing their systems to the brink.
Yeah, you know, that's something that I had thought to ask a question about. You know,
yeah.
Don't you think that they would have some kind of safety protocols automatic built into these ships that wouldn't let them overload and explode?
Yeah, or at least you'd need somebody like Scotty or somebody, you know, an engineer level to disable that stuff. Yeah.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, like I was thinking about cars. You know, like we have cars today. I mean, you can jam the pedal down and go as fast as you can go and the car's not going to explode. but these ships, you know, it's like they're pushing the engines, and all of a sudden, you know, you can push them to a level where the whole ship explodes and kills everybody on board.
Right.
Yeah. Very strange. So Uhura has a replacement in this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, a face, a familiar face,
mm-hmm.
dating back to what? The Doomsday Machine, I believe.
It was a while ago.
Yeah.
Long, long while ago.
Yeah, that's Elizabeth Rogers as Lieutenant Palmer.
Yep.
And she was also on Metamorphosis and the Doomsday Machine. I'm not sure. I think Metamorphosis was first. Or Doomsday Machine was pretty early.
Doomsday Machine was early in season two. So, yeah. So we got Chekhov and Sulu.
Yeah,
which is cool.
Yeah, it's cool to see that. But then you see Uhura's not there and you're like, oh, man.
No full cast.
Yeah.
Almost a full cast. But so.
And this is like the pestering Kirk.
Yeah, he can't wait 2 seconds for the answer. I mean, you know, so the beam was instantaneous, but
yeah, he's like, he doesn't know that Scotty's got to do his job.
Yeah, really. Did you notice? I mean, I've seen this episode so many times, but this is the first time I actually really paid attention to it. But you notice they're all wearing like half a slice of hard boiled egg on their shirt.
Yeah, that's
did you great. Notice that? Yeah. Like, I was like, wow, and they must have been eating dinner or something. When they got beamed out and they dropped the egg and it got stuck on the shirt, but they all have one. Yeah. How cool is that?
It's too funny.
So,
I think there's a major plot difference we should talk about here.
Sure.
In that one of the co-writers of the story here was Michael Richards, which is a pen name for DC Fontana, who asked to have her name removed. Because in her original story treatment, it was McCoy's daughter, and not, you know, Chekhov's former flame, if you will.
Oh, that would have been so much cooler.
It would have definitely added a much different dynamic to the episode. And I think DC, Dorothy, has talked about, you know, when you have it not be McCoy's daughter, the episode loses a lot of its weight.
Sure, I completely agree, and I think that's compounded by the fact that the Chekhov character is written so differently in this episode.
Yeah, and actually Walter Koenig has talked about that as well. If you pick up These Are the Voyages, Season 3, the section on this episode is really, really good.
Absolutely. I encourage everybody out there to pick that up and read it if you're interested in it, because there's a lot of really cool information in there that makes this episode appear a little bit different than you may have a viewed it before.
Yeah.
So, speaking about Chekhov in this episode, and so, you know, when Chekhov was originally brought into the show, he was brought in to appeal to a younger audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was more of the kind of funny, sort of kind of comic relief, youthful spirited guy, and in this episode he's like a by the book rule quoting he's got a stick up his butt.
Yeah,
really, really weird. I mean, I guess you could possibly attribute that to the fact that he really dug this chick.
Yeah,
and now seeing her again has made him you know, put him into a defensive mode. Maybe that's an explanation for his oddball behavior, but it's very noticeable. There's another one of those hard-boiled eggs, by the way.
Yeah, and that is actor Victor Brandt playing Tongo Rad, born 1942. And we actually saw him previously as Watson on Alon of Troyes.
Oh, yeah.
Also on Gomer Pyle, USMC, Mission Impossible, The Odd Couple, T.J. Hooker with William Shatner,
right.
20-some-odd years later, or almost 20 years later, and Murder, She Wrote.
Ah, a lot of good shows in there. Too bad he never wore his purple wig.
Yeah, I guess T.J. Hooker was only like 15 years after this.
Yeah, yep, that's about right. So this is really cool. I love the fact that Spock speaks space hippie.
Yeah, it's one of the most interesting things about this episode is how tuned in Spock is. And we know, and especially when it's convenient, Spock is sort of all-knowing. But here you don't really think he'd be, you know, hip to the 23rd century hippie culture.
Well, I think it implies, at least in my mind, I think Spock's familiarity with this subculture or you know, way of life implies to me that it's bigger than just this small group.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, this exchange of dialogue, part of it was sampled on a White Zombie album.
Really?
Their breakout album that had Thunderkiss 65 on it.
Awesome.
La Sexorcisto, Devil Music Volume 1. I don't remember the track, but there's a whole breakdown that has, you know, Herbert, You Are Stiff, and I'm Not Herbert, and We Are One. It's a really cool use of the dialogue.
Oh, that's pretty awesome. I'll have to check that out. I'm not a big White Zombie fan. No offense to anybody who is. I'm not saying that it's bad. I just never listened to it. So I would love to hear this. So if you can clue me into what song it is, I'd love to check that out.
I will. As soon as we're done, I'll forward it. Maybe you can drop it in the show notes.
Excellent. Excellent. So we're getting a breakdown at this point of what the hippie movement entails in the future. And it's pretty similar to what the 60s hippie movement was, you know. But in this case, the one difference is that they're actually in search of a planet.
Yeah.
A planet called Eden, which, if that sounds familiar to you and you're a Star Trek fan, it should sound familiar. It also very closely parallels the plot to Star Trek V. And I often wonder if that concept was lifted wholesale from this episode or the plot of this episode, because they even call it Eden. You know, they run down a list of all the names that the different alien cultures in the universe refer to that planet as,
yeah.
And Eden is one of them. So, you know, there are, and you know, my affinity for Star Trek V, which I've talked about before, and we'll get much deeper into as we get into the films later on. I love the fact that this episode is loosely tied to Star Trek V in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking, Craig, I think that you and I mean, we're just two small guys, but I really think if we tried hard, we could recoin the Herbert insult. You know, I think, you know, sometime at work, if some stuffed shirt gets on our nerves, we could just call him Herbert, you know. You're such a stiff, Herbert.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get an explanation as to what Herbert means. I like the fact that they explain it later on. Spock will explain. Actually, I think it's right here. Spock will explain what Herbert actually means. Interesting side note. Spock is going to kind of tell us in a roundabout way that he does kind of see... you know, these people's point. He sees their way of life and he understands them.
Yeah.
And he understands them because he feels similarly as they do. He feels, you know, as an alien amongst people as they feel they're aliens and outcasts. So this is interesting character connection between Spock. And we've seen this from Spock before where he, you know, feels he has trouble fitting in.
Right.
And it's cool that he has kind of a connection to these guys and they immediately respect him because they're kind of almost kindred spirits in a way. Although Spock doesn't necessarily subscribe to their way of life, he respects it at least. Mm-hmm. So pretty cool. A little extra Spock stuff here. And it's always nice to see Spock get to flex his muscles a little bit in the third season. So you know, he doesn't really get to do a lot.
Yeah.
So in this episode, it's nice to see him out and about and doing things. So, Dr. Severin is the leader of the space hippie movement here. And we've seen the giant modified ears he has. I'm not sure if those are attachments or some sort of genetic mutation or something. It's hard to tell what the intention behind those was.
I thought maybe in intergalactic high school, he wrestled. And he didn't wear his headgear and he got
cauliflower ears. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Big space cauliflowers.
Yeah. Here comes the Herbert discussion, by the way.
Ah, good. Good.
It's somewhat uncomplimentary.
Yeah.
Herbert was a minor official, notorious for his rigid and limited patterns of thought. So he's a square.
Yeah. So Captain Kirk is a Herbert. And I love how Kirk takes that.
Yeah.
He's going to try to be less rigid in his thinking. You know, Kirk exhibits a lot of his more diplomatic capabilities in this episode. He remains calm in the face of things that I don't think I would remain calm in the face of.
So here's Charles Napier on the guitar-like instrument.
This is the first musical number of the episode.
Yeah, and doing his own vocals there.
I love the fact that this song, this episode, has multiple musical numbers in it.
Right?
I mean, you know, we've seen a trend in modern television where a lot of shows will do a musical episode.
Yeah.
So maybe this is the beginning of that trend we're seeing here.
Yeah. Now, what do you remember Charles Napier from?
I remember him from something, but I'm losing
There's a big, big one related to another show me and you do.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Huh.
He was Murdoch in Rambo First Blood Part 2.
That's right.
Yeah. And also, I think what a lot of people probably know him from is The Silence of the Lambs. He was the guy who Hannibal Lecter cuts his face off.
Right.
To use as a disguise.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. He's got a lot of credits when I looked him up. Mission Impossible, The Rockford Files, Starsky and Hutch, BJ and the Bear.
Wow.
And in film, he also did, in addition to Rambo First Blood Part 2 and The Silence of the Lambs, The Blues Brothers. And he also was one of the controllers in Austin Powers. I think that see the Bob's Big Boy.
Oh, right. Yeah, there wasn't Clint Howard in that scene too?
I think it was Clint Howard and Charles Napier there.
Oh, yeah. All right, yeah.
He died back in 2011 at the age of 75.
R.I.P.
But it was hard to watch this episode, and it wasn't until I did the research that I remembered all that other stuff. Me and you really know him as Murdoch, but you don't see Murdoch in this episode.
No, not at all. Not at all. It would have been kind of funny if they had a picture of the Adam character somewhere in a scene where you see Murdoch. That would be kind of cool. Nice little throwback.
So now here we get a little bit of the backstory.
Yeah. So they knew each other in the academy, which is, that's cool. We have a little bit of a Chekhov backstory. We also learn Chekhov's middle name.
Oh yeah, his full name here.
Pavel Andreyevich.
Yeah.
Chekhov. So that's kind of cool. Little backstory for Chekhov. It's always nice where they fill out a little bit about these characters, and it's always nice to learn a little bit more about them. Even though we don't really get much more exposé about Chekhov in the series. They didn't do a lot of character building for him, and unfortunately Sulu. It's nice that they let him have the good-looking girl this episode. And Kirk didn't even make an attempt to steal her.
Yeah.
Which is cool. And, you know, when we're going to get a kind of a close-up here of Koenig's face. And do you think... I'm convinced that he's got eyeliner on.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. It looks like he has almost as much makeup as the woman here.
Yeah. Definitely looks like he's got a good amount of eye makeup. And he's even got a little bit of shadow on the top when he blinks his eyes in the corners there. There's a lot of contrast around his eyes. I wonder if they did that just for the close-up.
Yeah.
To bring out his eyes. It's interesting. So now I was wondering if you also noticed that a lot of these space hippies are barefoot, but Adam gets to wear boots. I wonder why that is.
Yeah,
that's interesting. I wonder if that's like a conscious choice, or if it's like, you know, it's not a requirement to be barefoot. I don't know. So here's our first real exposure to this odd Chekhov writing, where he's really he's given this chick a hard time.
Oh yeah,
you know, he's even sending her away now. I mean. You know, they're kind of going over a little bit of their history, and he's sending her away. Now, if this was Kirk, Kirk would have been making out with her right then and there. But, you know, you gotta give Chekhov the props for having a stronger sense of duty than even his captain does. You know, he kind of stays the course and remembers his job and doesn't get sucked in at that point.
And I actually found a quote that I wanted to read from Koenig here that was,
sure.
I guess it was aired on the Sci-Fi Channel episodes in the 1990s. And There's an excerpt here in Mark Cushman's book, and he says that this episode, this to me was a reflection of what was happening to the show, that care was not being taken at this juncture. They were just sticking the characters into a situation, and rather than writing the dialogue to fit the character, they had the character fit the dialogue. So I felt it was a corruption of what little we know about Chekhov and was very contradictory to what I had been trying to establish.
Well, I'm glad that we have picked up on that without hearing that quote first. I'm glad that we were picking up on that difference and we wound up sharing that sentiment with Walter, because it is absolutely true. Absolutely true about this particular episode. And a lot of the third season episodes are that way too. The writing doesn't feel the same. The characters in a lot of instances don't feel the same.
Yeah, it feels like you're just plugging people in.
Yeah, for sure. Here's a good shot of that cauliflower ear.
Yeah, on Dr. Severin there.
I've never really been able to figure out for sure if that was supposed to be his actual ear or something that he was wearing.
I think it's supposed to be his actual ear.
Really?
I think so, yeah. Or so some kind of body modification, but it's definitely not something that he takes off when he goes to sleep.
Interesting. I wonder if when he wakes up in the morning, they're flat against the side of his head. So we don't see a lot of characters with ears modified that heavily.
No,
they're almost like monstrous in a way.
Yeah.
So what we've learned now, this is a really interesting plot point in this episode that we've kind of just let pass without talking about it. And this, I think, is another one of the moments in Star Trek that reflects a concern of the time that's still really relevant today in 2015. So Dr. Severin is a carrier for an illness that was kind of born out of the heavy use of drugs and sterilization of society. So he's got this an illness in him that's resistant to medication because of the, you know, all of the conditions that people live in the future.
Right.
And, you know, therefore he's dangerous to be around because if you catch it, you're pretty much done for.
Right.
So he's been kind of quarantined and kept away, and he's restricted from traveling to places without vaccination. And, you know, today we are running into situations where we have a whole movement against vaccination.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get into that quagmire on this show, but I find it interesting that we're treading over some of the same ground here 50 years later.
Right.
That they were concerned about back in the 60s when they made this show.
Oh, yeah.
So, fantastic. Another prediction of the future from Star Trek. And, you know, that to me is what really makes this show so timeless and insightful to watch. And, you know, I hope that I know our listeners appreciate that, too. And I really hope that this show endures another 50 years because of it.
Oh, yeah, I definitely think it will.
Phenomenal. So the hippies are misbehaving yet again, and Kirk has sent Spock because Spock reaches. So they sent Spock down to talk to Severin in order to try to get the hippies in line. And this is a really interesting exchange, I think.
Yeah.
Between Spock and Severin. So I thought that this was an incredibly awesome olive branch on the part of Spock to offer to use the power of the Enterprise, the computers of the Enterprise, and the data at his disposal to help find the planet Eden that the hippies are looking for, that Severin is looking for.
Yeah.
And not only that, but he's also willing to put in the good word with Starfleet to allow Severin and his people to begin colonizing that planet.
Yeah.
That's pretty friggin' big of him.
Oh, totally.
It's a huge, huge gesture. And all Severin has to do is ask his people to behave for enough time for them to get to the nearest starbase.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But as we'll learn, he is not he's not of sound mind.
No. And Spock really does a good job of keeping his composure and, you know, still maintaining that offer and convincing Severin to speak to his people, although it does backfire.
Yeah, yeah. And this is actor Skip Homier, born 1930. He actually started out as a teen actor. He was active from 1944 to 1982. Shows like Playhouse 90, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Wagon Train, The Outer Limits, The Addams Family, Perry Mason, Rawhide. And we've also seen him on a previous episode of Star Trek in Patterns of Force. He played Melikon.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so a couple of familiar faces this episode, which is something I know we always get a kick out of.
Yeah.
Especially definitely. If you listen back to probably our Patterns of Force commentary, I probably teased that he would be popping up in The Way to Eden.
I'm sure you did. And I have to say that this Briggs scene is an exceptionally good scene for him. I think it's another one of those great guest star performances.
Yeah.
From the third season. So there are moments here where he gets misty-eyed, glassy-eyed while he's giving his impassioned speech. And I think that's a really great trademark. It's a really great ability that an actor or an actress can have to be in that much control, to be able to emote in ways other than using language.
Right.
So phenomenal job. And
a cool shot here too.
Yeah, I love how Spock is a little bit blurred in the background while we were looking at Severin. I really like that top costume piece that Severin has. Some of the costumes in Trek, and especially in the third season, were a little ridiculous, but I really like that. The pattern on that's kind of a little spacey. You know, pretty cool.
And I like Spock's diagnosis here.
Yep, he's insane. Done. He's just crazy.
I love Bones. Check him out. I mean, is there a test Bones can run? I mean, is Bones the type of doctor that can confirm that?
I don't see why he couldn't.
Yeah, I mean, if there's nothing physically wrong with his brain, though, I mean, how do you determine if somebody's insane?
That's a good question.
I mean, there's not a you know, you don't draw blood and.
No. No, but I'm sure there's some sort of a scan they can do on his brain to see if there's
the activity and how. Yeah, it's worked.
There must be something. I guess. I mean, this is Star Trek, so they're able to do everything with a tricorder or the medical little tricorder thingy. So, I wouldn't doubt that they could do that. Not like today, but Spock also made a really great point when he was talking to Severin earlier, and that is that even if he does find the Eden planet, he would wind up killing all the people that live there.
Yes.
They're looking for a primitive people, and the disease that he carries with him would, in fact, wipe them out. So, you know, it's almost futile for him to be searching for this planet if he really does, you know, care about these primitives who he thinks are going to solve all of his problems.
Yeah.
He's obviously clearly not seeing the consequences of his actions, which I think is what Spock used to determine, or partially determine his insanity diagnosis.
I love this slang here. That's now. That's real now.
Yeah, I guess it's modification of the current hippie jargon from that time period, the late 60s time period.
So. And I like how Adam here is completely, you know, trying to, you know, manipulate and play Spock, but he's doing a real good job of it. You know, he's impressed with this Vulcan instrument and, you know, it looks like they're making a connection as musicians, but we'll learn that this is all completely transparent.
Yeah. I like to think that it's at least partially sincere on Adam's part. Well,
they're connecting as musicians, I think, or at least Adam is tuning into that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Adam still respects Spock, at least for understanding his movement and respecting his movement. So, I mean, you know, there is an ulterior motive, of course, and I wouldn't deny that. But I think that Adam, at least in some capacity, has a respect for Spock.
Yeah.
And we see a little bit more of that later on, although his devotion to his own cause is stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So
here we come with the big, I guess, space seed con moment where vital pieces of information that can be used against the ship are doled out.
Yeah, that's yet another So I had thought to bring up that up in discussion as another one of those. Shouldn't they have some kind of security protocols in the ship that don't allow unauthorized personnel to enter certain areas like auxiliary control? I mean, wouldn't there be some sort of security there that says, you know, this chick doesn't have access to this room?
Yeah.
She shouldn't be allowed in here. I mean, this is one of the nerve centers of the ship, and they should be off limits. And of course, there should also be, you know, protocols for the officers and what they can and can't divulge about the operations of the ship.
Yeah.
You know, in the company that we work for in our real lives, there are things that we're not allowed to discuss with people outside the company.
Yeah.
Right. And that's just, you know, proprietary company information. You would think for the safety of the ship, there would be the same type of a mandate on board the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Especially consider they should have learned this lesson from the many different hostile forces that have taken control of the ship.
Right. Right.
So at any rate, good thing you brought that up. So anybody has an opinion out there in listener land, you know, feel free to weigh in at something we'd love to talk about. But she's really putting the moves on Chekhov, and he's starting to crack. He's starting to crack. Would you crack, Craig?
It really depends on what kind of past we have.
Nah, she's quite the attractive young lady. I mean, I can see why you'd have a hard time resisting. Yeah. Good for you, Chekhov, you know. It's been a while. It's been since Spectre of the Gun, right? Since he had any sort of a female love interest. So that was a while ago. So time to blow the dust off, Chekhov. Yeah. Give in. Everything will work out anyway. But I love that Chekhov gives a really nice explanation about how he does his job during this sequence. So, you know, he lets us know that he's able to pilot the ship or plot a course using just the data in the computer. So even if systems on the ship broke down, he'd still be able to navigate,
right,
and plot courses just based on star data that he has and other calculations that he can utilize the computer to make. So very cool to hear a little about the technology. I know one of Roddenberry's mandates was not to explain the technology and get lost in it, but it's still nice to hear little bits and pieces about how they utilize the technology.
Right, yeah.
So very cool. Very cool.
So this actress here playing Arena,
mm-hmm,
or Arina,
mm-hmm,
Mary Linda Rapelle, born 1944. And I think it's funny how many people we see on this show that went on to do soap opera work.
Oh, really?
From 69 to 71, she worked on Medical Center. And then from 80 to 85, she was on As the World Turns.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so very a lot cool of former Trek people found steady work in soap operas.
That's excellent. That's excellent. Always nice to have a steady gig,
yeah,
working in television as an actor or actress. So I'm going to have to look it up and see what how she progressed. I'm interested. So
yeah. Here we now have the full I love this shot here.
That's a great, great shot.
Such an ominous close to that commercial break.
Yeah, the villain, you know, shot.
Yeah, we learn that they're just going to kill them with kindness, basically. And before we get into this musical sequence, we'll talk real quick about the direction, since we mentioned that shot. It's director David Alexander, who also directed Plato's Stepchildren. So we've talked about him before.
All right. He directed two controversial Trek episodes.
Yeah, you know, with disruptive childlike people.
There you go. So is that a Chekhov body double right there?
I don't think that's Chekhov.
It's not. You see him from the front.
Yeah. You think that guy probably doubles Chekhov at some
point?
He
could have been Chekhov's stunt double. Chekhov. Sulu. Sorry. Sulu.
Yeah.
Sulu stunt double.
Totally. He totally looks like he could be Sulu.
And is that Dr. Mbenga sitting on the bench there? That's a Dr. Mbenga body double.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of extras in this scene.
And I would love to see the drawings for this instrument.
Oh, for sure.
It's string. It seems like a string-based instrument, or at least simulating strings. But it also seems like it has synth-like properties because Adam is able to change the tone of the instrument at the, you know, with the press of a couple of buttons.
Yes.
And so it's a very all-purpose instrument.
It is. And that explanation that you just gave kind of maybe helps to negate what I was going to say. And that is, it doesn't, the sound that's coming out of it doesn't seem to match the strumming that he's doing.
Yeah.
But I think if you explain it that way, that it makes more sense, and it kind of explains away a little bit, at least, my suspicions about that. There's the villain again.
Yeah, and I love how Spock comes in with his axe.
Oh, yeah.
He stands and patiently waits for them to finish this song before he sits in with the band.
It's a very interesting song. It happens in multiple phases. Oh, you know, that was really weird. We watch the episodes while we're recording this. We watch them with subtitles on so that we can follow along. So you're seeing the
hashtags?
I'm seeing hashtags.
Yeah.
In the subtitles.
I guess that's the universal sign for singing or music.
Yeah.
For, you know, instead of saying, you know.
I think that's the first time I've noticed that in Star Trek.
Me too. Yeah. The hashtag.
Yeah. That's a long hashtag, man. I think that's longer than a tweet.
Yeah, it is definitely longer than a tweet. So there we go, and now Spock is going to be asked to join in.
Yeah, you know, one thing, one thing I really love about this episode is that these songs were written and recorded specifically for this episode.
Yeah.
You know, these aren't, it's not like like Bitter Dregs that we heard in Plato's Stepchildren. These songs were actually specifically written for this episode, and I think that's fantastic.
Oh, totally.
And she's playing a bike wheel, yes. She's playing a bike wheel.
And just the idea of Spock jamming, it really, and here we got like a modified, it's like the ear pinch.
That is the single most ridiculous thing in this entire episode, I think.
The ear pinch.
Yeah, and he does it twice. He does it again. I think, to me, I mean, I can excuse a lot of the things that go on in this episode, and I will go on record saying I don't think this episode is nearly as bad as the rap that it has, but that move right there is absolutely ludicrous. There's no way in the world that would work. If Spock did it and it worked, I could buy that because of his mental powers. I would imagine that, you know, putting the thumbs in the contact of the back of the skull could enact some sort of a, you know, some sort of mental connection he can use to knock people out. But this is just a regular guy. You know, how does pushing your thumbs against the back of somebody's ears knock them out? And here we go again. Here it is. Watch, everybody. Here we go. Bazinga. And the guy's out.
There he did it almost on the shoulders, it looked like.
Yeah, that's so weird. That I don't buy. But I buy playing a wheel as an instrument more than the ear pinch.
Yeah, and I love how Spock was done. He got up and he walked out.
He's like, I'm out. I was only contracted to do one number with you people. I did my obligatory number and I'm out.
It's the equivalent of like dropping the mic.
Yeah, he was like, I just killed it. I just killed it. You can't possibly top that performance. I have nothing left to do here.
Yeah. So now we've got a little bit of drama as Sulu has noticed that they're not in control of the ship anymore.
Yep. All right, listeners and Craig Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a serious question for you. And I know you can explain this away in Space Seed, but how can you possibly explain how Severin and his people know how to operate the Enterprise computers? Okay, Khan read the manuals. I understand that. They did not have time or access to read the manuals and learn how to control all of the ship systems, let alone reroute everything to auxiliary control.
Well, somebody had a Starship knowledge, though.
Because yeah, but I mean,
the one they stole at the beginning of the episode.
Sure, but an entirely different class of ship. The Enterprise is far more complicated than a tiny little shuttle-type ship.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, you know, that would be like the difference between getting into, you know, a Toyota Corolla, starting it up and driving, or getting into a giant tractor trailer starting it up and attempting to drive it. I mean, they're two completely different beasts, and, you know, knowing how to drive a little car doesn't mean you wouldn't be able to know how to drive a big complex truck.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. I guess you'd have to suspend your disbelief, but I would like to think that in reality, the Enterprise wouldn't nearly be that easy to commandeer. Now, if they had done it in such a way that they were able to convert some of the Enterprise crew to help them in their cause, then I could probably buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just them. So, at any rate, if anybody out there wants to debate that, feel free. Feel free. I'd love to talk through it with people. So, friend of the show, Steve, I'm sure you have an opinion on that. And, let us know. Let us know. So, interestingly enough, here's a moment where Adam appears to at least kind of quasi-listen to Spock a little bit, but then dismiss it, you know, because he doesn't really want to believe what Spock is saying. But you get at least an inkling that Adam at least is pondering it a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Spock is really good. I mean, I love the dialogue here, you know, saying that he knows what Adam seeks and he understands it, but there's a difference between what Severin is doing and what Adam and the people really want. So Severin, of course, is out for himself. You know, he's willing to let these people, he's using these people as tools and willing to sacrifice them to get where he wants to go. You know, so he truly is insane, but I guess his people are so blind that they can't see.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously he's gotten to the point where he's now doing things that are against what they believe in. So he's going to rig up an ultrasonic sound that will not only disable but kill the people on the Enterprise.
Oh, man.
Which we know is against what they really believe in.
Oh, totally.
So interesting to see that there really is some madness there, and Spock was definitely onto something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I love how that circuit panel that Severin's playing with looks kind of like a battleship board.
Yes.
Doesn't it? There you go. See, he just moved the submarine. And that's right in the middle of the game. That's illegal. You're not supposed to move him once you place him, right?
No.
So I wonder, that's some sort of it looks almost like one of those Radio Shack project boards. Remember those where you could buy the blank circuit board and all the little pieces to plug into it to make different things?
Maybe, oh, yeah.
A transistor radio or a little blinking light. That's kind of what it looks like to me.
Oh, yeah.
So I always love to see the inner workings of the ship. You know, you see modern Trek movies and modern science fiction, and the insides of these ships are so complicated with wires everywhere, but it was so simple back then, 69. It was just a little tiny board that you pulled stuff out of and plugged stuff into. Complex ship systems. So here we learn that Irena is a bit concerned about what Severin is going to do to the Enterprise crew.
Mm-hmm.
Which is cool. I mean, I think it shows that she really wants to stick to what she believes in. You know, she's using the scientific knowledge that she has from her training to let Severin know, listen, what you're doing is going to kill these people.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Severin kind of talks her out of it. But Tongo also knows, but he doesn't seem to really care as much. So, interesting. Interesting dynamics between this group. And I think the other two girls just really don't do much.
No.
They're just kind of clingers on. But a pretty cool effect coming up here, too, by the way, in a minute or two, where we're going to see an effect that likes to get used in Star Wars and other sci-fi movies, and that is the laser beam cutting through a wall.
Oh, yeah.
I love that. How many times have we seen that? And wasn't that one of the opening scenes of the Star Wars first prequel?
Phantom Menace. Phantom Menace. There's a kick butt lightsaber sequence.
Yeah, cutting through
a battle door, right? I think they call it.
Yeah, I love that Scotty's doing this, and if you watch later on, after they get up off the floor to go into the room to deactivate this sound, you see that charring is still on the wall.
Yeah.
Which is a cool little bit of continuity there. I like when things work out and you just notice this burn mark on the wall. So cool that they remembered. There it is. And it's actually still on fire and smoking at that point. But you'll see it again when everybody wakes back up. Poor Nurse Chapel took a heck of a spill.
Oh, yeah.
That wasn't even a stunt double.
No. Took a nice bump there.
Oof. I hope she was okay. Yeah. I wonder, scientifically speaking, is it possible to knock people out using sound?
I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. There's probably frequency ranges out there that could accomplish it.
Okay. Well, if anybody out there has a background in this stuff or has any knowledge of it, let us know. I'd love to know if that is actually possible. Or not just knock people out, but kill them. Could you actually kill someone with sound? Hmm. And I'm not just talking about making them listen to Meatloaf records. You know, I'm talking about this high-pitched ultrasonic sound that's being used.
Yeah.
Here. More great physical acting from Shatner.
Oh, totally.
That not quite Stallone-level pain acting, but still pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's doing their best, but I think Shatner really pulls it off. There's the burn on the wall.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, very cool. Yeah. And here's that impatient Kirk again, calling every section of the ship. He calls the hangar deck. Why would he call the hangar deck? You never hear him call the hangar deck.
Yeah.
I mean, they did take a shuttlecraft, but he doesn't know that yet. Mm-hmm. So. And control of the ship is not back yet, but at least now they have auxiliary control. And the Romulans, fortunately, have not found them, which they are in Romulan space. So the planet Eden is in Romulan space. It's been there the whole time. The Romulans knew where it was.
Yeah.
So all they had to do was call the Romulans. But it kind of reminds me of the scene from Holy Grail where they come up to the castle and the French guy pops up on the top and they've had the Grail the whole time. We've got one. So you call up the Romulans. Hey guys, you know, we're looking for Eden. You happen to know anything about it? Oh yeah. We've already got that. We found it already. Oh, well, where is it? We're not going to tell you. We found it though.
This feels like probably the most rushed final 10 minutes of an episode.
Oh, for sure. For sure. This episode probably could have benefited from some different pacing.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you get to like the less than 2 minutes left in the episode mark.
Yeah, it really accelerates.
Yeah, you're wondering, like, you're looking at the counter saying, is this a two-parter?
Yeah, I mean, you're we're beaming down. And there's a reused piece from Shore Leave in here, by the way. Real brief one. Yeah, here we go.
Oh, it's beautiful.
That's great.
Absolutely gorgeous.
I would love to see that in real life. But so now here's a serious one for you, Craig Cohen, and for everybody else out there. So back to the Star Trek V connection. So in Star Trek V, when they find Eden, it's a desert-like planet.
Right.
And in this episode, it's more of a paradise. A paradisical planet with, you know, of course, we're finding out that all the plant life is acidic and poisonous. But, you know, I wonder if is it supposed to be the same Eden? Is this the same planet they find in Star Trek V?
I don't think so.
So you think this is a false Eden?
Yeah.
So anybody out there, but by the time this episode is over and you listen to this, there's a little bit of a clue that comes at the end of this episode that makes me believe one way or another. And I'll reveal that when it happens. But at this point, this is a very different Eden than we see in Star Trek V. So, but then again, I mean, it could be, if it is the same, I wonder if that godlike creature is there somewhere on the planet. Remember what we thought was God for a little while.
Yeah.
Star Trek V. So poor Adam. I feel bad for poor Adam. I don't think that he deserved to die. You know, he was a kind of a cool dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought maybe one of the lesser hippies probably could have bit it, but I guess they wanted it to be more impactful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's a real shame.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. But I think there's a lesson to be learned there of some kind.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. Let me know when you figure it out.
So then we get the full-size shuttlecraft.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
The Galileo 2, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some pretty gruesome effects on their feet, as their feet have been burned by the acidic grass.
Yeah.
And Severin, of course, is the worst of them. But, you know, we're getting kind of close to the end of the episode here. And I think that this is kind of tragic to me. And this is kind of a very, very sad ending if you really think about it. You know, here's a group of people who seriously believed in something, and they really believed that this planet and this destination would be their salvation. You know, this is what they lived for and you know, committed crimes to find, and you know, blood, sweat, and tears, only to get here and find out it's not what you thought it was.
Yeah. It's kind of like when the Nazis open up the Ark at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah. Kind of, sort of.
Although they get what they deserved.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, they were on a quest that has results different than they desired.
True.
And this has to be some really, really potent poison fruit.
I mean, sure. The instantaneous death.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's I don't know. I find that outcome to be very sad. I mean, I really would have rather have seen, you know, some kind of a demise for Severin, but the rest of them, you know, got to live in their Eden. I think that would have been pretty cool. But unfortunately, I guess they all have to go back to Starbase, whatever.
Yeah.
And face their charges. But
you also don't know that in Severin's insane state, that what he experienced could have been completely different.
Hmm.
It could have been him experiencing nirvana.
Sure.
Before dying.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Can't dismiss that. So I love that Chekhov submits himself for discipline because he feels he's screwed up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Kirk, of course, being a good captain, lets him off the hook so that he can say goodbye to, you know, his former potential girlfriend that we think that was his girlfriend. And of course there's some feelings there. Now here comes the reveal that I think tilts this one way or another in favor or not in favor of this being the same Eden from Star Trek V, and Spock is going to reveal that he's saying that it's his sincere wish that she does not give up her search for Eden.
Ah, okay.
Which makes me believe that Spock is acknowledging that this wasn't the real Eden.
Yeah.
You know, this was a false positive. But an interesting thought on that, though, is that the Enterprise computers were wrong in identifying that as Eden. Or perhaps they just didn't have enough time to fully vet the data.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess the conclusion is that it's not the same Eden from Star Trek V. But cool thoughts anyway.
Very good catch there.
Like that. So that's it. That's the end. So yeah. Essential or not?
I'll come right out of the gate and say that I think this is definitely an essential episode.
Really?
And I say that because if you institute any kind of cocktail party rule here, I think any episode of this series that you're going to consider one of the worst, people have to be aware of. And people have to see it for themselves to make that decision. So just for the how notorious this episode is, I'm calling it essential.
All right. Very interesting. So I am going to fall on the essential side myself. Strangely enough, I was pretty on the fence about it, but I think I'm going to give it a short essential, like, you know, maybe a 55 to 45 essential because of the Chekhov backstory stuff. So I've given essential votes to other episodes that had character backstories included in them. So I can't really discount the Chekhov backstory that we get from the girl that he went to the academy with, had a relationship with, and the reveal of his middle name. You know, I think all of those are enough to say that this episode deserves to be watched just to get a little more information about Chekhov himself. So the fact that it's that gets the cocktail party nod from you is pretty cool, because I would have given it an honorable mention for the cocktail party reason.
Yeah, yeah.
So, all right. So that's awesome. It's a double essential. We haven't had one of those for the third season for a little while. Not many of them, but good thing. So we will be back next week with another regularly scheduled commentary episode. Another one of my favorite third season ones. So I'm looking forward to that.
Ah, very cool.
All right. So we will see you all next week on the Tricorder Transmissions.
There's a very interesting story behind the genesis of our next episode, The Way to Eden. It was originally called Joanna and would have been written by Dorothy Fontana. Every television show has what's called its Bible, a printed document used by the show's writers and directors. It sets out the format of the show and gives background information on each of the characters. During the time Dorothy Fontana worked on the show, she contributed to our Bible, in particular, generating material on Dr. McCoy. Dorothy's version of the story intended to illuminate McCoy's reasons for being in Starfleet, telling us that he joined following his marriage breakup. Her idea was that McCoy's daughter, Joanna, would come aboard the Enterprise, 20 years old and idealistic. She and her friends were searching for a paradisical place to live. The conflict in the story would have been a mutual attraction between Joanna and Kirk, forcing McCoy to view Kirk in a completely new light. Although Fred Freiberger liked the idea, his vision of McCoy was that he was the same age as Kirk, so too young to have a 20-year-old daughter. He asked Dorothy if she could write around the same premise but replace McCoy's daughter with Chekhov's former girlfriend. Dorothy tried the modification, but she could not make it work. In the end, the script assignment was given to Arthur Heinemann. Although Chekhov was given a lot of screen time in the show, upon reflection, I think this was the lowest point for me during the entire series. As I read the script, I noticed that Chekhov had suddenly become a really inflexible, establishment-loving conservative. I mean, this was supposed to be a character drawn conscientiously as an identifiable approximation of the young people of 1969.
Yea, brothers.